The food we eat can go through a long journey before arriving on our tables, from farms and fields to markets or supermarkets, and then to our homes. Each stage in this journey can look very different, depending on who controls the process. On a farm, is it a small-scale farmer who plants and harvests your produce? Where do they get their seeds from? Do they share seeds amongst themselves, as they have done for thousands of years? Or do they buy them from companies? Why, during the pandemic, did nearly a billion people go hungry while food and agriculture giants made exorbitant profits? In this podcast series, we will look at who controls our food systems and how those trends are changing. We will investigate which companies are starting to take greater control of commercial seeds, of farm machinery and grocery retail. We will look at how and why big tech companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, Google and Alibaba are moving into food. And we will examine new trends unknown to most people, like carbon farming and digital platforms. Join us as we take a look at who controls and who will control our food systems. In East Godavari district, Andhra Pradesh, in India, an Adivasi farmer gave his personal data and information, including his phone number, to a representative of the Indian government. In India, Adivasi is a collective term used to refer to indigenous people. The farmer later learned that this information was made public and embedded in a GIS map. He was also made to join a farmer producer group and was part of a platform called Producers Market, which claims to facilitate direct relationships between consumers and producers using emerging technologies and digital devices that are supposed to protect farmers from small traders who exploit them. The farmer was made to believe that this project was good for him as well as for agribusiness companies. But was it? How are big data and tech in agriculture moving into the territories of indigenous people in India? What narratives are employed to appeal to farmers? And what are the consequences? I am Zahra Malou. In this third episode of Who Will Control the Food System, I will speak with Sagari R. Ramdas, a member of the Food Sovereignty Alliance in India. Sagari is a veterinary scientist and a popular educator at the Kudali Learning Center, where she facilitates education programs in social justice, food sovereignty, and buen vivir. She writes and works on issues related to social justice, food sovereignty, livestock, and ecological governance. I will be speaking to her about disruptive technologies in indigenous territories in India. Sagari, thank you for speaking with me today on Who Will Control the Food System. How did you come to be aware of and to work on the impact of data and new technologies in the territories of Adivasi people?
We are an alliance where members are from Adivasi communities and different Adivasi communities from across Telangana and Andhra Pradesh. And one of the inquiries which we were really investigating, coming out from conversations and dialogues happening within the alliance, was this entire hype about this project, which was earlier known as zero-budget natural farming, and very much kind of talked about agroecology project funded by the state of Andhra Pradesh. And we were involved in and decided through the alliance to actually interrogate and really unpack what was going on in this agroecology project, which is, in fact, even as we speak today, being so globally championed as one of the great success stories of upscaling agroecology with state support. And the reason we had so many questions was twofold. One, having lived a history in Andhra Pradesh, which is one of the first states in India to have experienced all-out entry of capitalist markets in the last 30 years of what is called liberalized, economic reformed India, which was nothing else but deregulation of the state and replacing the welfare state with a market economy. And in the course of investigating this agroecology model, we stumbled across all these various connections of how data and new technologies were being just tested out in territories of Adivasi peoples and beyond, without their knowledge, without their consent, without any of the requirements which are actually written in according to the constitution and according to the law.
You've mentioned these different projects at BNF, and in you wrote a piece about this, and it seems like the process through which Adivasi farmers are being incorporated into new agriculture value chains that are overseen by big tech involves having farmers join producer organizations and then having their lands designated as compacts. This is something you write about. And then these are then placed on a map by a platform called SourceUp. You've explained a little bit how these digital platforms or these digital sort of technologies work, but can you explain a bit more in detail, for example, what is SourceUp and what are these digital technologies that are being used?
In our own investigation, we've come across several prototypes which are being tested. There's another one which you mentioned in the introduction, something called Producer Market, for instance, which seems to be one of these blockchain, one of the major central pieces of making these supply chains more, you can track these supply chains, you can actually do things like traceability, etc. So this Producer Market, for instance, was one such blockchain-fired platforms, which was connecting ZBNF produce via producers in one part of an indigenous area in an Adivasi area in Andhra Pradesh, and then via this producer market, sell it to consumers, right? Consumers can then access and purchase via this kind of a platform. And similarly, then we discovered this other platform, which terms itself SourceUp. And if you go into the SourceUp website, you find that SourceUp elaborates and describes itself as a collaboration platform for supply chain sustainability at scale. And it's a platform that links agri-commodity companies with multi-stakeholder initiatives in producing regions. So the way they describe themselves is that it is a platform which is connecting markets in producing areas for responsible, and this is the term which is used, for responsible sourcing at scale by linking stakeholders in these producing areas along supply chains. And what they basically do is that they are linking our buyers and producers via what they call this creation of compacts. They describe a compact as an area which brings together different stakeholders. There are governments involved, there is civil society, there are NGOs, there are private sector, and the actual producers who are aggregated through these farmer producer organizations. And that is then designated as a compact. And then, of course, it's mapped out and it has satellite mapping. They use all kinds of technologies, Google Cloud involved over there. They have links with something called Trace, which again seems to be yet another company which is bringing together all kinds of digital technologies to enable traceability. So what they basically do is that this is designated as a compact. They describe it that a compact has a power to transform agriculture production systems far beyond what an individual producer or local governments or civil societies or traders can do alone. So it brings everybody onto this landscape. So you're really talking about a landscape level sourcing, where then essentially what they begin to do is they start dictating indicators. So they're indicators of sustainability. Finally, the power of who decides the indicators, who sets the terms for that, rests with SourceUp. And then when you look into who then is the, who forms this SourceUp, you come straight into the people who have created the problem in the first place. You're talking about people like Unilever. You're talking about people like PepsiCo, Carrefour, JBS. I mean, these are the big bad boys in the business, right? What we read into this is like you're trying to whitewash. You have this kind of packaging, which is creating a narrative that it's all okay. You know, these are good people. What we're trying to do is good for the earth. We're talking sustainability. For us, what's of deep concern is that you've designated a compact, which is an indigenous territory, which is governed differently, which is governed by the laws of the land, which is governed by indigenous people who have rights there, who have the right of consent, who have the right of rejection, and they don't know that their area has been designated a compact.
But it's quite complex to understand in terms of the different layers of, you know, a land being designated as a compact in terms of platforms like SourceUp and then who's behind that. It sounds like a whole digital infrastructure. And so you're mentioning that the agribusiness corporations that are actually behind these technologies. So Unilever, PepsiCo, which other companies are involved in these digital platforms, and how are they benefiting from these digital technologies on Adivasi lands?
So when you go in, again, I'm just referring back to SourceUp, for instance, they have a global steering committee. And when you look into who forms their global steering committee, it is Unilever, it is PepsiCo, it is Mars, it is the Tropical Forest Alliance, it is something called ProForest. And when you go deeper and you look at their other partners over there, as I said, there are people like Carrefour, there are people like JBS. So now these are big business. When we investigated deeper into Unilever, for instance, Unilever has this entire setup where they are today, they're really investing in digital technology so that they can source soya, coffee, cacao sustainably. They are using their technologies such as, I think there's AI, there is cloud, there is blockchains. They want to actually trace. I mean, it's tracing. It's almost, to me, it sounds like digital surveillance, you know, to figure out where in the supply chain are there any breaks in terms of, are there other small traders who are what they define as leakages. So there's, when you look, go into the Unilever site, for instance, they talk about how they are encouraging people to take photographs of small traders. And then these are posted onto their website. And then there's another layer of how that then all gets incorporated into other forms of digitalized satellite maps. I mean, the whole thing sounds to me as if it's, essentially, what it appears to me is that they use the technology for one to have complete control from end to end, you know, this entire ecosystem of end to end from producers right to the plate, as it were, to the consumer. So what do they gain? They gain there's a sanitization of the agribusiness, right? There's a sanitization of the agribusiness which is happening when they join into such platforms where, you know, globally, for instance, the APCNF is today being seen as what a wonderful project of agroecology. This is the Andhra Pradesh Community Managed Natural Farming, which is the big agroecology farming project, which people are so kind of taken in. It's being championed globally. I think right now as we speak, even in COP28, it's one of these big projects being shown as a model of how sustainable food systems can be actually created through this kind of agroecology models, which are financed by the state. So how do agribusiness benefit? Let's not forget that today in this entire game of digitalized farming, data and the control of data is so key. So the agribusiness today, whether it's Unilever, go into their website, they are into data. Go into PepsiCo, they are into data. Go into any big agribusiness who today has an interest in food, all of them have an interest in data. So all of this is providing them amazing free access to data, which then, of course, they are then going to utilize in furthering their own business. Secondly, all of this is being promoted as the sustainable way in which business is being done, in which your food is being sourced. So they are actually using these digitalized technologies, and here when I look at the Unilever references, they talk about the different kinds of technologies they're using. There's something called anonymous data signals they're getting from mobile phones. There's satellite imagery and artificial intelligence. There are photos which they are getting done through crowdsourcing. And then they are identifying through that, quote unquote, illegal traders. Because as I said, all these technologies and all these models are being pushed on the premise, and they are pushing this narrative that everyone else except themselves are exploitative traders. So small traders, small little people who are in the business of buying and selling, and these are the areas of the supply chain today, which in a country like India are still very, very highly fragmented. These are the supply chain points which the big agribusiness wants to close. So when they talk about closing the supply chain, this is exactly where they're using their technologies, using these digital technologies to really then be able to strategize, okay, how do we then push out those small traders and take over and build the entire supply chain in those regions? It's about data. It's about who controls data. It's about who is setting these indicators of sustainability. So Unilever is involved in a compact in Aceh in Indonesia, which is about palm oil and soya. You see that for them, they don't even recognize that people exist in these forests. There is a relationship of indigenous people in the forest, which is not taken on board when they come up with these indicators of sustainability. So their indicators of sustainability are like how much of deforestation has not happened. They don't look at things that the entire base of palm oil itself is so destructive, right? Mm-hmm. So today, in the case of the Adivasi regions, shifting cultivation, for instance, is a very core part of their food farming system. But shifting cultivation will be of the indicators of sustainability. It will definitely be show up as an indicator of non-sustainability. So the way that indigenous people are interacting with their forests, the way they go and collect forest produce, the way they go and hunt, the way they go and forage, the way they practice shifting cultivation, the way they govern their forests, where they graze their animals, all of these will be considered as unsustainable. What the agribusiness is gaining, as I said, one is they're gaining control. They're gaining control through data. They're gaining control over the decisions around what we define as sustainability. They're also then advancing their monopoly over the entire food system, because they're talking not about just one region or one landscape. For them, it's about this entire global supply chain. So for me, this is exactly where the agribusiness, and the agribusiness is being facilitated by the state.
It's interesting that they have managed to turn the narrative upside down so that small traders are seen as a negative part of the food system, whereas agribusiness are able to paint themselves as the good guys. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will look at how agribusiness has co-opted agroecology and how the Indian government has built a whole agri-tech ecosystem. Back to the third episode of Who Will Control the Food System. So, Sagari, you've talked about this move towards agroecology as a way for agribusiness to paint themselves as sustainable. But how are they able to do this? Because we know that agroecology is a practice or a movement that's been promoted by the food sovereignty movement and by smallholder farmers. And in fact, it's shown itself to be the alternative to the agribusiness, corporate or industrial food system. So how have these agribusiness companies managed to paint themselves as sustainable and engaged in agroecology?
Well, they've managed to do it because of the state. And, you know, this is today, and I think the nature of the state is something that we as movements need to be really looking at very crucially. If you look at the FAO and the fact that, you know, everybody internationally and globally was so excited when agroecology was formally recognized as the by the FAO, right, as one of is the way forward to really set right the system, this completely agribusiness corporate control system of food, which we have, and all the unsustainability of industrial farming, corporate farming, etc. At the same time, today, when you have, say, for example, the example in India of Andhra Pradesh with this agroecology model, where the state presumably is financing this project, you have to look into what are the sources of those finances coming to the state. And the state today is the one who is leveraging and providing, because the states are so indebted already. You know, India's own indebtedness to the World Bank and IMF runs into nearly, it's huge. It's huge percentages of what our GDP is. And where literally the states are willing to get any form of financing, including from, as I said, the agroecology model in Andhra Pradesh, is being financed. One of its financing sources is BN Paribas. And we know how dirty BN Paribas is. BN Paribas is one of the worst banks financing dirty coal, fossil fuel, everything in the book. So when the state is agreeable to this kind of financing, these kinds of partners, that is how the agribusiness is getting their validity. It is the state. And so we are not willing to interrogate what lies behind the state, right? Mm-hmm. And that for me is very important. We need to really be looking much deeper. It's not just about, oh yeah, this is a state-financed agroecology upscale model. Wow. No, we have to be much more nuanced. We need to be 10 steps ahead of where the state is today, because we have fascist states, we have states which are controlled by agribusiness, we have states which are completely sold out to the advance of capital. We can't, just for the sake of advancing agroecology, cannot turn our eyes away from what is the foundation. When we talk food sovereignty, we're talking about bottom line equality of, for instance, land ownership. Andhra Pradesh has one of the worst and most unequal land ownership realities in India. How can you talk agroecology on such a foundation of inequality? So, you know, these are the questions which I think we in the Alliance, we have to really be looking at the state. All the analysis, when you look at the government of India, its policies, its agriculture policies, you ask the question about how come today the agribusiness is the good guys and the small traders are the bad guys. But in all the analysis, I mean, ever since I remember the liberalization process in India of the 90s, the small traders, the small people who are the procurers have been the ones who've been constantly, we've been flagging them as the exploiters. So I go back to when the first kind of deregulation of markets in India was one of the earliest happened in the dairy sector. And today, of course, the dairy sector is pretty much controlled by, you know, a handful of dairy agribusiness processors, which are cooperative, but corporate. Okay, they're agribusiness cooperatives.
So going back, you talked about this whole trend coming about with liberalization. But in terms of technology and agriculture and technology moving into the agricultural sector, when did that begin? Is that something, you know, is this something that happened relatively recently? Is this something that's been growing more rapidly? And are there any regulations in terms of this trend of big tech moving into agriculture within India?
So I would say it's something that has been really, it's been underway since the last decade or so. The government in power today, who's pretty much been in power since 2014, they have powered this in a way that we have not seen before that. And of course, the arguments which they use, when you look at the government website, they set it up by saying that the agriculture sector has multiple challenges. And some of the challenges they flag is like, one of the main one they flag is at the level of production, then market linkages, supply chain, climate change, weather hazards, all of these. And then their solution for these are agri-tech solutions. So I'm now just going to describe to you what the government of India has set out to how this agri-tech ecosystem has been built. some of the areas where the government of India describes this, and it's on a website which is actually anchored by the Ministry of Commerce and Industry. This is called, and it's called the Indian Brand Equity Foundation. So this is another thing which has happened in post-liberalization. You have government ministries which are actually floating foundations. And these are foundations which then they just kind of like amplify the voice or the of the government. But it gives you a very clear idea what is being set out. So for instance, you know, they talk about how the India's agri-tech sector opportunity, which is valued today at some $24 billion, has a market penetration of less than 1% today. Therefore, what they're basically saying is that they envision that there is 99% of that market still out there, which needs to be controlled. And which are the areas where they see it? So they've listed these out as well. So they list out segments they call downstream ag techs, which are, they call them and describe them B2B and B2C platforms, which are linking, going to connect farmers, or already underway, connecting farmers with businesses and consumers. Then they have digital solution and precision ag tech. So these are digital solutions being given to farmers, or services which are advising them on precision farming, sensor-based solutions, and their companies like Cropin, which have been able to, they've been able to raise investment for that. Then they call midstream ag techs. These are like agricultural technologies which are providing supply chain solutions on logistics, on warehouses. So they're companies again, which are, they've been able to, they've raised finances and are already operating here. Agri-biotech, farm to fork, upstream ag tech. So these are like Bayer and all the different seed and agrochemical companies and nutraceutical companies providing, really investing over here. And then agriculture financial tech as well. And this is where they are really looking at providing credit, providing insurance. And you already have these kinds of people who are operating in the landscape. And some of the opportunities which they look at and they say, which is there for agri-tech, and they're trying to really create an environment where agri-tech startups, right now, apparently there are some 450 agri-tech startups already in the business. They want to really make this a space for agri-tech startups, and they've listed it out. Where do they see these opportunities? For one, they say that the small holders, right, all the different, because India is about 84% of the Indian farmers are small holders. And where do they see agri-tech coming in there? But to be able to really influence, and they use these words, influence the lives of smallholders by offering access to loans, insurance, inputs, market connectivity. I mean, all this kind of thing. Then climate change. I mean, they want agri-techs to be offering paid services to farmers on weather forecasting, satellite imagery, you know, when to plant what. Increased mobile internet and smartphone penetration. So already they're seeing this as an agri-tech startups who can be digitally interacting directly with smallholder farmers. Then they have described very clearly the role of government in agri-tech. How has it made it easier for digital to reach the farmer is through farmer collectivization. So very clearly the government has said is that they have created farmer producer organizations, funding it to the extent of something like $750 million over the next 5 years to establish over 10,000 farmer producer organizations. And why? Because these will be aggregated a farmer base, allowing the agri-tech firm to really access and scale up their business model. So secondly, and this is something we have to understand very clearly, is that they have developed something called AgriStack. They tested it out initially through models in different states. For instance, in Andhra Pradesh in 2015, it was tested. Basically, this AgriStack is a centralized, they've created or developing a centralized database of agriculture data sets that's going to be linking all the information of a farmer into this centralized database. And then the government is essentially going to allow agri-tech companies to access this data so that they can then tailor-make their products to sell back to the farmers.
So basically what you're saying is that at all levels of the agricultural, the food system, you have these digital technologies that are capturing that part of that agricultural system with the aid of the state and through the aggregation of farmers as a market through these farmer producer organizations. So just to talk about the farmer aspect or the farmers that have been co-opted into this, into these technologies, the narratives that these agri-tech companies and platforms are using are to convince farmers that these technologies are actually good for them. How has this been received amongst farmers? Has this been convincing to them? Have a lot of farmers bought into these systems? Because it seems like it's been, you know, it's the scale of what you're describing seems huge. What has been the response from farmers to these new technologies?
You know, the indigenous Adivasi farmer did not even know that their FPO or that they were joining, they just thought it was yet another group. Okay, so that being informed that this group is an FPO, which with this intent that it when you get aggregated, you would potentially be linked up at an upstream and a downstream level to various kinds of agribusiness institutions has not even been informed to the Adivasi. They were completely unaware that their group is even part of this larger design. And that for me, for us, is the most critical point, that you were not informed. The relationship of the state, particularly in an Adivasi territory, there's been a very strong welfare role the state plays, right? There's a trust relationship built up that, okay, if I have a problem, I go to, say, the Integrated Tribal Development Agency. When that agency is bringing in a particular program, there is an implicit kind of a sense of, okay, I will trust this because at the end of the day, this is the group which is also providing me other kinds of welfare services. And, you know, farmers in India is not a, it's not just one homogenized kind of grouping. There are middle farmers, there are large farmers, probably more like medium level farmers and medium to large level farmers. Many of them are actually probably benefiting or maybe buying into these narratives. So it really also depends on the locationality of where you are.
What are some of the sort of long-term consequences for small farmers in terms of being co-opted into these processes and becoming part of these processes?
I think very, very crucially is here the question of your own control over the decision-making control. Even today, when the system of farming is pretty much set up to be pushing monocultures, moving away from diversity, moving away from the actual principles of food sovereignty, it is the real fear of who is going to be making those decisions. Like once you get into being controlled right from what seed, and already when there are farmers, even small farmers today, even Adivasi farmers who may have already, say, put up substantial proportion of even their little small holdings under, say, one commodity crop. Okay, so this is really where we come into that realm of a commodity farming based system. It could be cotton, it could be tapioca, it could be cocoa. Once you are still being able to make that choice of, okay, I'll put a certain proportion of my land under a crop, or I will choose between, even if it is one company seed versus another company seed. But I think that once you get into this entire digitalized system, it is about losing complete control. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, control over even having the knowledge in you, right? Today, like an indigenous person, even a small farmer traditionally, you can read signs of weather. You can read your soil. You're a scientist. At the end of the day, you are a scientist reading your soil, reading your weather. You have got systems of local sharing of knowledge, of co-producing your knowledge, of co-creating your practices. All these amazing networks of, say, of how you select your seeds, how do you store your seeds, how do you decide a combination of crops, all of these are constantly co-creating your knowledge based on your praxis. It's a reflexive system. It's an ongoing system. And if you are going to be tied into completely and a system which is controlled by big tech, big ag, your mind will lose the ability to think. The way we are building our resilience is actually building our webs of people webs, right? Our people webs of seeds, our webs of knowledge, our webs of praxis. It is no point in just having your land rights. And in all these systems seem to be, all these agribusiness seems to be very clear. Yes, we want to see rights in place. But the rights discourse, of course, having your rights are so important. But the rights discourse, if it is based on inequality, number one, and beyond rights, all these different questions of the decisions and the governance and the control and the knowledge are so core. So whether it's through AI or machine learning and all of these elements, it's essentially alienating you as a human being, you as people, from your minds. And I think that's such a scary kind of reality which is coming up.
Thank you very much, Sagari, for speaking with me today. That concludes our third episode in the podcast mini-series, Who Will Control the Food System? To find out more about agriculture and big data, please visit ETC Group's website, www.etcgroup.org. ETC Group also has an animation which breaks down the digitalization of agriculture, called Big Brother is Coming to the Farm, which you can also find on ETC Group's website. You can find all our podcast episodes on the ETC Group website or on Spotify on ETC Group Podcasts.